Thank you so much for the special music. There's something special about our congregation. We have such talent, and to have a chorale sing on a holy day is really special. And it even brings me back to the Passover, to have the people participating in the readings. It just really makes it special. So thank you, choir, for your hard work. It was absolutely beautiful. Welcome to all those on Zoom. I'm sorry you're not able to be here in person, but you are here in spirit, and we hope you are having a great holy day as much as we are. And we look forward to after services, having the luncheon out and back. So this is a wonderful day. So it's good to be here with you all. In my previous message, Becoming Who We Already Are, we found that believers are to see the Christian journey as a journey of alignment, aligning our actions, aligning our attitudes, aligning our thoughts with the identity God has given each and every one of us: chosen, royal, holy, special, saints, different from the world, children of God. And we had three themes we conveyed. First, the Passover defines us, emphasizing that deliverance sets us apart and establishes that we belong to God. And unleavened bread shapes us. It highlights that growth is just not about removing what is wrong, removing sin from our lives, but what are we substituting in our lives? Are we substituting sincerity, truth, and godly character? And finally, these days teach us to look ahead in faith, trusting God's ongoing process rather than looking back at past habits or comforts. It's about moving forward and not going backwards. And hopefully we spent these days reflecting on living an unleavened life, a life of moving forward, looking ahead in faith, trusting God's ongoing process rather than reliving our shortcomings of the past. Now we're here, the seventh and final day of unleavened bread. What we're keeping today is a holy day with rich tradition. According to Jewish tradition, the crossing of the Red Sea occurred on the seventh day. The dramatic event destroyed the Egyptian forces and secured Israel's permanent freedom. It was far more than just a mere escape. Yet deliverance was only the beginning, and God did not leave the Israelites standing on the shore of the Red Sea when they crossed it with a simple, "Good luck, hope you're going to make it, you're on your own." No, instead, he led them through the long road in the wilderness to Mount Sinai. In the same way, even though we're concluding this holy day season with the last day of unleavened bread, our journey continues. It doesn't stop at our Red Sea. It continues forward to Pentecost. And this ongoing journey of becoming who we already are revolves around an offering that took place during the days of unleavened bread in ancient Israel, the wave sheaf offering, and the counting of the omer that occurred during the days of unleavened bread. Wave sheaf, also known as tefuah, appears elsewhere in the Pentateuch, Exodus 29 for priestly ordination, Leviticus 7 for peace offerings, Leviticus 14 for cleansing a leper. In these rituals, the sacrifice is physically waved or lifted before God in a symbolic presentation, after which is given to the priests for their use, or in some cases burned. The waving was a way to show that the offering now belonged to God, while acknowledging that he's the one who provided it in the first place. The wave sheaf was a specific type of wave offering. In ancient Israel, the wave offering outlined in Leviticus 23:9-14 was an annual observance on the day after the Sabbath following the Passover on the days of unleavened bread. A freshly harvested sheaf of ripe barley was brought to the priest, who waved it before the Lord as an acknowledgement of the entire harvest coming forward and belonged to God. The offering was accompanied by a male lamb and fine flour mixed with oil and wine, and no new grain could be eaten until it was presented. The ceremony expressed gratitude in what God had provided, consecrated the harvest beginning, and served as a public testimony of dependence on God rather than on human effort. And we commemorate the sacrifice of Jesus Christ with the Passover. Likewise, the wave sheaf functions as a foreshadowing of Jesus Christ's resurrection. Just as the sheaf represented the first fruits guaranteeing the full harvest, Jesus rose from the dead, becoming, in the words of Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15:23, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. If we would turn there, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 20 through 23. And it states, "But now Christ has risen from the dead, and he has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since by man came death, man also came the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ all shall be made alive. But in each one in his own order, Christ the firstfruits, afterwards those who are Christ's at his coming." Effectively, the wave sheaf started the clock for counting the days toward Pentecost. And when discussing the wave sheaf offering, we will hear about the Omer, which is Hebrew term for the word sheaf, the measured bundle or dry volume, approximately 2 liters of the first ripe barley that was harvested, prepared, and waved by the priest during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Turn to Leviticus 23, verse 10. Leviticus 23, verse 10. And it states, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf," or Hebrew, the word omer, "of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest, and he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it." The sheaf, or omer, represented the very first portion of the spring harvest, acknowledging God's ownership and provision. No new grain could be eaten until it was offered. Furthermore, the waving of the omer initiated the 50-day period as commanded in Leviticus 23, verse 15. So if we go down to verse 15 here, and it states the Feast of Weeks. "And you shall count for yourself from the day after the Sabbath, from the day you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath, then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord." God says we are to count each day from the beginning of the weekly Sabbath of the feast during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the day the wave sheaf or the wave omer was brought, for a total of 50 days leading up to the Feast of Weeks or Pentecost. And the number 50 has significance in the Bible. It conveys completion, restoration, liberation. We can think of a jubilee year in this light. But who is to count? Who is the you referenced in verse 15? Is it Moses? Was it the high priest? Was it the Levite? Who is the you? Let's go back to verse 1 of chapter 23. And it states, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, The feast of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts." Moses was told by God to speak to the people. The you here is the people, the Israelites. They were to count the days. It wasn't the responsibility of Moses, the high priest, the Levites. They were all, everyone was to count the days. Why count? Although the Bible doesn't specifically explain the reason, there's insights that emerge from Israel's historical experience, both in the wilderness and after receiving the law. Counting the days reminded the Israel that their identity as God's covenant people called for continual reflection and obedience. Counting also allowed each generation to mark the days leading to Pentecost, the time when the law was given, fostering reflection, gratitude, and spiritual preparedness year after year. And also, the counting gave each day significance, linking every generation to the historical journey of their ancestors. During this day and age, we do not have the wave sheaf offering, the waving of the omers, as something we practice. This was fulfilled by the resurrection of Jesus Christ. However, there remains 50 days between the wave sheaf or omer that was waved in the day of Pentecost. And thus, the principle behind counting the days from the waving of the sheaf or omer to Pentecost is something that I believe has value for today. And it may be something that we've never thought of before. The last day of unleavened bread usually ends with us heading out to the store and hurrying up and getting some bread or bread product like a good old-fashioned donut, and going back to our normal routine until Pentecost. And then a few days before Pentecost, we go, oh, yes, the holy day's coming up, and we start thinking about it. But God told the Israelites to count each day from the first barley sheaf was offered until the feast of Pentecost, paying attention to each day as it passed. We can choose to walk between now and Pentecost with purpose, considering this is a time of transformation, of continued transformation. That is the principle behind counting the Omer. And counting the Omer wasn't meant to be just a calendar exercise. And if we focus on that, we miss the meaning of the days leading up to Pentecost. It's an opportunity to consider our deliverance, the spiritual Passover, the Red Sea crossing, our Red Sea crossing, into a deeper understanding of becoming what we are already in Jesus Christ, symbolized by the day of Pentecost. Counting the Omer reminds us that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the starting point. In other words, without the resurrection, there'd be no Pentecost. Spiritual maturity comes as we allow God to reshape our hearts, our habits, and dependence on Him day by day, just as He led and sometimes tested Israel from the shores of the Red Sea through the wilderness towards Mount Sinai. Although the formal instruction of counting Omer was not given until the Israelites reached Sinai, their very first journey out of Egypt unfolded during the same 50-day period we are now observing each year. From the moment of the deliverance of the Red Sea, they stood at the mountain, and when they stood at the mountain to receive God's law, and that in between time, God was teaching them day by day. In that sense, their wilderness experience was the original counting of the Omer, a living lesson in daily dependence and a steady transformation that prepared them to receive the law. During that wilderness journey, Israel faced three pivotal experiences that tested them, that shaped them. And I would like to discuss each one of these experiences as seen on the timeline of the slide, which I'll show shortly. And we'll use that as principles as we should consider in our lives, which leads us today to the title of today's message, Counting the Omer, A Journey of Transformation. And the following formative events will be covered: the bitter waters of Marah, the manna and the quail, and the battle of Rephidim, which happened to the Israelites prior to them receiving law in the covenant of Mount Sinai. And we will examine these defining moments, drawing practical lessons that we can learn from in applying the principle of counting the Omer towards Pentecost. The first formative moment for the Israelites in their journey to Mount Sinai was Marah, the bitter waters made sweet, found in Exodus 15, 22 to 26. Just a few days after their triumphant crossing and song of victory at the Red Sea, Israel encountered their first major test: no water. When they finally reached Marah, the water was undrinkable. It was bitter. And their immediate response was to complain. Let's go to verse 25 of Exodus 15 and see what happened next. Exodus 15, verse 25. It states, Then Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood, and he threw it into the water, and the water became fit to drink. There the Lord issued a ruling and instruction for them and put them to the test. Verse 26. He said, if you listen carefully to the Lord your God and do what's right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all his decrees, I will not bring upon you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. When we go through our challenges in life, when we go through difficulties or maybe unmet expectations, maybe it's discouragement or doubt, sometimes bitterness can enter our lives. We think, at those times, we don't only think of our glass as half empty, we think of it totally empty. As we take pause each day between now and Pentecost to consider our journey, to effectively count the Omer, we should consider if we have bitterness in our life. Now, we may think, no, we don't. However, do we have unmet expectations? After the Red Sea, the people expected fresh water but found bitterness. What hopes, and plans, or prayers that we felt have not been answered that left a bitter taste in our lives because things didn't turn out as we expected? Do we have relational hurts or betrayals? Sometimes we make our own waters bitter through our relationships with others, unmet expectations that we have seen. Or do we have self-bitterness or condemnation? Sometimes we're the ones who make our own waters bitter through shame and regret or harsh or even unrealistic self-evaluation. What failures or shortcomings do we beat ourselves over? Where do we in our lives see things as being unjust? Our feelings of being treated unfairly. Maybe it's at work. Maybe it's with our families. Maybe it's just our everyday interaction with the world, and that has left a lingering resentment. As we consider counting the Omer, the days now between now and Pentecost, we should ask ourselves, has any bitterness taken root that is impacting our lives? Proverbs 14, verse 10. Proverbs 14, verse 10. Proverbs 14, verse 10. State the heart knows its own bitterness, and the stranger does not share its joy. This proverb teaches that our deepest emotions are ultimately personal, not fully accessible to others, and thus we keep them to ourselves. Sometimes they take a toll on us, they fester. And the proverb notes, the heart knows its own bitterness. Each person carries private pain, grief, or struggles that others may not fully understand, even close friends or family. And no stranger shares its joy. In the same way, our deepest joys are also uniquely experienced. Others may celebrate with us, but they don't feel exactly as we do. In this context, bitterness is a deep and personal emotional reaction. Yet as we see in Ephesians 4, verse 31, we need to address this bitterness and remove it from our lives. Ephesians 4, verse 31. Ephesians 4, verse 31. Says, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Here, Paul is instructing the follower, the believers, to completely remove not just the outward anger, but also that inner attitude of resentment that can poison relationships and poison the community. The word here for bitterness is pikira. And the word pikira comes from a root meaning the word pointed or sharp. It describes something that lingers internally like sudden anger, or it's more like an ongoing resentment. And in Greek usage, in ancient Greek usage, it could refer to emotional harshness that affects speech and behavior. In short, the bitterness here is used here is a deep, ongoing spirit of resentment or harsh bitterness that shapes how a person feels or treats others. Hebrews 12, verse 14. Hebrews 12, verse 14. It states, pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Look carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this may become defiled. Hebrews 12:15 teaches that believers must be watchful, not only with regard to their own spiritual condition, but also over each other, ensuring that no one drifts away from God. The writer of Hebrews warns of the root of bitterness, which he describes hidden growing resentment that can take hold of the heart and surface in harmful ways. Like a root underneath the soil, it begins unseen, but over time, it spreads, causing conflict, division, and spiritual harm, not to just the individual, but to the entire community. The account of the waters of Marah in the book of Exodus in chapter 15, 22 to 25, provides a picture of how bitterness can be removed from our lives. When the Israelites came to water that was too bitter to drink, they complained. Moses cried out to the Lord, and God showed him a tree. When cast in the waters, made it sweet or drinkable. In the same way, the bitter experiences in our lives may not be able to be healed by our own efforts or through complaining. In those cases, we need to bring them to God. And just as the tree of Marah transformed the bitter water into sweet, drinkable water, so the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, symbolized by the cross, which is made from a tree, transformed the bitterness in our hearts when we surrender it to him. And this echoes the commands in Ephesians 4, verse 32. We read 31 earlier, be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you. The lesson of Marah shows that bitterness is not removed by ignoring it, but by bringing it to God and allowing him to transform it at the source. Then we do our part. We work to substitute bitterness with kindness, forgiving one another, as we have been forgiven by God, and pursue peace with all people. This is where the Spirit of God, given to us because of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, can heal the bitterness. The second formative moment for the Israelites was on their journey to Mount Sinai was the daily bread from heaven. In Exodus 16, the Israelites began grumbling against Moses and Aaron because they were hungry and longed for the food they had in Egypt. And God heard their complaints, and instead of punishing them, he promised them meat in the evening and bread from the heaven in the morning. Let's turn to Exodus 16, verse 13. Exodus 16, verse 13. And it states, so it was the quail that came up in the evening and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew laid all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. And later in verse 16, Moses instructs them to gather an omer. Once again, the measure of an omer is used per person each day with no leftovers, and a double portion on the Sabbath. A double portion was gathered on the sixth day before the Sabbath. Just as the Israelites grumbled in the wilderness and long for familiar comforts of Egypt, we may find ourselves complaining when things become difficult, especially when we compare it to seemingly others who have it so much better than we do. With ancient Israel, God responded to their need, not with immediate abundance, but with daily manna, to teach them and us a lesson. A profound lesson, a personal lesson, that true spiritual growth comes through learning to depend on God one day at a time. Today's manna represents God's daily supply for us spiritually, his word, His presence and His Spirit that we should reflect upon each and every day. As Jesus Christ declared in John 6, verse 35, if we would turn there, John 6, verse 35. States in John 6, verse 35, and Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. The quail and the manna remind us that after our deliverance from spiritual Egypt, God doesn't let us to fend for ourselves. Instead, he invites us in a daily walk of faith to become who we already are, by replacing complaints with contentment, replacing self-reliance with dependence, and replacing anxiety with simple trust in the one who faithfully provides what we need each and every day. In our lives, the manna represents the daily provision of Christ Himself, His Word, His presence, and the grace He gives us, which we must consider each and every day. That is why Jesus taught us to pray, give us this day our daily bread, and followed it with a gentle instruction. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. Manna reminds us that after our deliverance from spiritual Egypt, God doesn't let us fend for ourselves. Instead, He invites us to a daily walk of faith where we become who we already are by replacing the complaining and self-reliance and anxiety to trust God in our journey. Proverbs 3, verses 5 to 6. Proverbs 3, verses 5 to 6. It states in Proverbs 3, verses 5 to 6, trust the Lord with all your heart and lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your paths. The third formative moment for the Israelites on their journey to Mount Sinai was Rephidim, the victory over the Amalekites. Let's turn to Exodus 17, beginning verse 8. Exodus 17, verse 8. And I'd like to read from the New Living Translation for this section of Scripture. Exodus 17, verse 8. It states, while the people of Israel were still at Rephidim, the warriors of Amalek attacked them. And Moses commanded Joshua, choose some men to go out and fight the army of Amalek for us. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill holding staff of God in my hand. So Joshua did what Moses had commanded and fought the army of Amalek. Meanwhile, Moses, Aaron, and Hur climbed to the top of the nearby hill. As long as Moses held up the staff in his hand, the Israelites had the advantage. But Moses' arm soon became so tired he could no longer hold them up. So Aaron and Hur found a stone for him to sit on. Then they stood on each side of Moses, holding up his hands. So his hands held steady until sunset. As a result, Joshua overwhelmed the army of Amalek in battle. At Rephidim, Israel faced a sudden attack from the Amalekites. Joshua led the fighting in the valley, while Moses stood on the hill upholding the rod of God. As long as Moses' hands were raised, Israel prevailed. When his arms grew tired, Aaron and Hur supported him till the sun went down and the victory was won. Our journey Our spiritual journey involves real spiritual warfare. We cannot win a spiritual battle on our own strength. We need to be consistent with prayer, the idea of uplifted hands, and the support of fellow believers when we grow weary. Amalek represent the persistent enemies we face, both outward and inward. Proverbs 27, verse 7. As iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. Proverbs 27, verse 7 offers a vivid picture of how relationships impact all of our lives. Just as iron becomes sharper when it rubs against iron, our interactions with others refine our character, perspective, and abilities. The sharpening process isn't always comfortable, but it's essential for growth. The right friendships and connections push us to reflect, improve, and reach our potential, while also allowing us to contribute to the growth of those around us. Here is how this principle plays out in practical ways. Healthy relationships make us better. Just like metal becoming sharper through friction, a healthy relationship can challenge us, can give honest feedback, and at times pushes us to improve. Growth often comes through discomfort. The sharpening process isn't always smooth. Honest conversations and debates and constructive criticism can feel uncomfortable, but they help us build character and skills and perspective. And there's a mutual benefit. It's not one-sided. Both people grow together in a relationship. A strong relationship involves learning from each other, not just one person teaching or correcting the other. But it also says that we should choose our circle wisely. The people you surround yourself do shape your mindset, habits, and direction. Supportive and wise and honest individuals will sharpen you, while negative influences can dull our perspective. In other words, Proverbs 27:17 notes that strong, honest relationships can help people grow and improve by not just being a cheerleader, but by supporting each other, sometimes even challenging each other, having an honest and sometimes even a painfully honest discussion. A painfully honest relationship helps all in the relationship. Ephesians 6, verse 18. And it states, "And pray in the Spirit on all occasions with the kind of prayers and requests. With this in mind, be alert and always keep praying for all of the Lord's people." Ephesians 6:18 encourages us to always stay connected to God through prayer. Not just occasionally, but it's an ongoing habit where we talk to God during our daily life. It highlights that praying in the Spirit means with sincerity, requesting guidance, and it's alignment, requesting alignment with God's will rather than just an empty repetition. The verse also stresses being alert and persistent, reminding each other to stay spiritually aware, not to grow careless or discouraged. Finally, it expands prayer beyond oneself by urging intercession, praying for others, that which reinforces a sense of community and shared responsibility, where supporting one another spiritually becomes just a part of living out our faith. 1 Timothy 2, verse 8. States, "Therefore I want men everywhere to pray, lifting up holy hands without anger or disputing." 1 Timothy 2:8 focuses on the attitude of prayer. It urges believers to pray without anger, without disputing, emphasizing that worship and communication with God comes from a heart of peace and sincerity, not from conflict, not from resentment, not from selfish motives, not from bitterness. This verse highlights the importance of maintaining a humble and pure mindset when approaching God, recognizing that prayer isn't just a ritual, just something we do, but it's a relational act that reflects inner character. It also underscores the communal aspect of prayer. Rightly praying can foster harmony, patience, and unity within the faith community. Exodus 17, verse 8 recounts the battle with Amalek, where Moses' raised hands determined Israel's success. His strength waned at times. He grew weary, but then he was supported by Aaron and Hur. And this scene aligns with Proverbs 27, verse 17, Ephesians 6, 18, and 1 Timothy 2:8, showing that this consistent biblical principle, spiritual and personal strength, is nurtured through support, accountability, and prayer. Just as Moses needed others to help him stay effective, people today grow through honest relationships, persistent prayer, and a peaceful, sincere approach to interceding for each other. Together, these passages highlight that growth, victory, and maturity, whether moral, spiritual, or relational, are rarely solitary endeavors. They flourish, and they can flourish in a community of encouragement, vigilance, and shared spiritual effort. The shared Spirit of God in our lives. In other words, koinonia. In this message, we have seen that Israel's journey through the wilderness prepared them to stand at Mount Sinai to receive God's law and become his covenant people. The Israelites faced three pivotal experiences that tested them, shaped them on their journey to Mount Sinai. First, there was Marah, the bitter waters made sweet. Bitterness in our lives is not removed by ignoring it, but bringing it to God and allowing him to transform it at the source. We work to substitute bitterness with kindness, with forgiving one another, as we have been forgiven by God. What things do we hold on to, that we should release to God? Manna, daily bread from heaven. God does not leave us to fend for ourselves. Instead, Jesus Christ invites us with a daily walk with him, replacing complaint with contentment, replacing self-reliance with dependence, replacing anxiety with trust in the one who faithfully provides what we need every day. And then there's Rephidim, victory over Amalek. Spiritual growth requires humble, sincere prayer and relational support We need each other in this journey. Just as Moses relied on Aaron, strength, maturity, and victory flourish through the community, through accountability, through persistent intercession, and shared encouragement, revolves around the concept of koinonia. Our journey from unleavened bread to Pentecost by counting the Omer, which is symbolic of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, prepares us for the meaning of the day of Pentecost. Let's reflect upon the principle behind counting the Omer, taking time each day to examine our calling, to examine our walk, to examine our journey as we head towards Pentecost. The principle behind counting the Omer is not just about marking time. It's marking transformation in us through God's Spirit. It's the process of becoming who we already are. Like ancient Israel, we move from deliverance to relationship with God by learning to trust in Him through hardships. We depend on Him daily. We stand firm. And with the help of others, we can battle the forces that are against us. The same God who parted the Red Sea, sweetened the bitter waters at Marah, provided quail and manna, and gave victory over Amalek, walks with us today in our journey to the kingdom. We need to do our part in the journey, but we also rely on the Eternal to provide for us along the way with the following promise. Philippians 1:6, "And I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ." God is not leaving us at our Red Sea moment. He will see us through. Have a great remainder of the Holy Day, and looking forward to seeing everybody after services.